force. We know that the planetary and the genetic are connected. The big trends on Earth have, since the beginning of life, shuffled the genes and shaped the evolution of life on Earth. But making real connections between the two, that's tricky. I mean, it's a long distance from the planetary to the genetic.
Don't forget to tell him we're orbiting in our spaceship, John.
Oh, I was just getting to the spaceship. Folks, meet Adam Burke. He's our program's producer, reporter. He's a mechanic, right? Think of him as the person who keeps our scientific metaphors in tip-top shape. Now, he's currently repairing a few mechanical things before we get underway in our spaceship. How's it going, Adam?
Fine. Almost done.
As I was saying, it's a long way between the planetary and the genetic. But scientists are making some connections.
Okay. All fixed up and ready to go.
Yeah, right. We got a program to do here. Okay, so imagine you're above planet Earth as we are right now in our spaceship. Man, that is one nice place to look at. Earth.
Not a bad view at all.
Not a bad view at all. It's Earth, for heaven's sakes. And if you stayed up here a long time, you'd start to see things. That's right. You'd see changes in response to a warming world. The glaciers at the poles are changing, as many have heard. But when we talked to Camille Parmesan, she's a biologist at the University of Texas, she told us that some of the biological changes underway right now would also be visible over time.
From space, what you'd be seeing is sort of an expansion of the tropics, tropical species moving into temperate zone species moving into boreal zones, the boreal forest moving into the tundra, and then the polar regions getting much smaller.
We tend to think that it's just a few exotic and polar species that have already started reacting to climate change. After all, the Earth has only warmed 0.7 degrees centigrade on average over the past century.
That would be 1.2 degrees Fahrenheit, John.
Thank you, Adam. A few years ago, Camille Parmesan and a colleague looked into just how many species had responded in some way to climate change. They compiled data on more than 1,700 species worldwide. Everything from plants to birds to butterflies to intertidal invertebrates to plankton. Across all of these groups, half of the species are showing some kind of a response.
Either they're breeding earlier, or they're shifting their ranges northward, or they're accelerating their generation time. So it's, you know, it's a little different depending on who you're looking at. But that's absolutely astounding that 50% of species are doing something different from what they were doing 30 or 40 or 100 years ago.
Parmesan says that about 40% of the species she's looked at have shifted their ranges away from the equator and toward the poles.
And this is a combination of shifting their breeding grounds, if they're a migratory species, or actually shifting where they live. So if they're a very sedentary species that doesn't move very much, they're actually shifting the whole region in which they live.
So this is one strategy for dealing with climate change. Species are moving to follow their climate. Not necessarily a new strategy, though.
During the glacial and interglacial cycles, the Pleistocene glaciations, species would move around by 1,000, 2,000 miles, trying to track their climate.
Of course, back then, creatures didn't have an obstacle course of freeways, farm fields, and cities to deal with when they moved. So this time around, some are managing and some aren't. But it definitely seems to be a popular coping strategy. Are there any others, Adam?
Well, there's timing. Parmesan told us that species are also shifting when they do things, too. So take spring, for example.
I love spring.
So we're seeing birds breeding earlier, frogs breeding earlier, trees leafing out earlier, flowers blooming earlier.
And you know, there's a growing body of science that says at least some of these shifts are genetic.
Really?
Yep. Ooh, speaking of timing. Pardon me.
What are you doing?
Seatbelt.
Whoa!
Okay, hold on.
Hold on. Hey, does that mean we're going in?
Oh yeah, we're going in. And then out into the living room of two scientists in Eugene, Oregon.
Whoa. Warn me about that next time, will you?
Yeah, like I'm going to warn you. It's way more fun not to warn you. Now listen. These scientists study an insect called the pitcher plant mosquito. Scientific name, Wiemeyer smithii, though William Bradshaw refers to it affectionately as Wiemeyer.
Wiemeyer is a mosquito that breeds only in the stomach of a carnivorous plant.
That plant grows in bogs all the way from the Gulf of Mexico to northern Canada.
Whoa.
Yeah, and its leaves are shaped like a small water pitcher.
No.
Really?
This is a pitcher plant that collects rainwater throughout the year.
And that's Christina Holtzapfel. She and her husband William Bradshaw are evolutionary biologists, and they've been studying the pitcher plant mosquito for over 35 years. So they're fairly well acquainted with the host plant and the mosquito larva, which is a
teeny tiny little
wrigglers, they're called. Now, these wrigglers live in the watery bowl of the plant, feeding on a buffet of mucky rainwater and disintegrating insects that are trapped there.
Delicious.
They have little orange mouth brushes, and those little brushes are filtering the food that they eat.
So that's what these little wrigglers do. All summer long, eggs hatch in the plants, and juveniles wriggle around, eating and growing, and eventually becoming adults. Takes between 3 to 4 weeks on average. But around late summer, early fall, these larvae come to a fork in the road.
That's right. They have to go back to mosquito school, right? I mean, they have to buy their lunch boxes. They have to get their fashions, new shoes, right?
No, John. Adult pitcher plant mosquitoes can't make it through the winter. So after a certain point in the year, it's no longer safe to turn into an adult. Around late summer, early fall, the larvae shift into a sort of holding pattern called dormancy, so they won't develop into adults until spring.
Wow, so they turn into like Peter Pan mosquitoes all winter long, just stuck in childhood, eating and wriggling around in the belly of the plant?
Yeah, even under the snow.
Whoa, but wait a minute. Didn't you say that the larvae start to go into dormancy around August or September?
That's right.
Well, how do they know winter is coming? I mean, fall hasn't even arrived yet.
Ah, that's where the plot thickens, John. They use the length of day.
When days are getting short, winter is coming. When days are getting long, spring is coming. And Wiemeyer has a highly accurate ability to measure the length of day. They can measure the length of day to within 5 minutes. And they use day length then to predict into the future when winter is coming and to time the onset of their dormancy at the optimal time.
These Wiemeyers can measure the length of day to within 5 minutes?
Yep. Birds use similar cues to determine when to migrate.
Really?
Yeah, they're not conscious decisions. They're genetic cues, hardwired into the animal.
So little clocks hardwired into mosquitoes and birds, what does any of this have to do with climate change?
Well, when Bradshaw and Holtzapfel started their research in the early 1970s, they didn't know it had anything to do with climate change. They were just studying the timing of when pitcher plant mosquitoes were entering dormancy. But in spring of 2002, they suddenly realized their mosquito work might have something to say about climate change and evolution. They analyzed data comparing the timing of dormancy over a 24-year period. Then, a bit shocked, they checked a 5-year comparison.
What we expected to see in the analysis of the 5-year data set was nothing. What we actually saw was that the mosquitoes were evolving in a tiny, short time frame, 5 years. That was just stunning to us.
We talk about evolutionary time, and we think evolutionary time takes decades or centuries or millennia to occur. And we don't think of evolutionary time being on the order of a few years. And when we saw the shift over a 5-year period, that said to us, this is evolution occurring at breakneck speed due to climate warming.
So wait a minute. Evolution at breakneck speed, what does that mean?
That means that populations of pitcher plant mosquitoes were evolving to shift the timing of their dormancy to later in the year. Timing of dormancy in the pitcher plant mosquito is genetic, remember?
Okay, right.
Okay, good. So here's how it works. Each population of mosquitoes has evolved to go into dormancy at a particular time of the year.
Okay.
But within any one population, there will be a range of responses.
Well, of course.
Some individual larvae will go into dormancy earlier, some go later.
Okay, I think I'm still with you.
The thing is, there are evolutionary consequences to the timing of all this.
Timing is essential.
Dormancy is all about timing. If you go into dormancy very, very early in the season, you haven't had an adequate opportunity to make lots of progeny or young.
If you go dormant too late, you die.
And that's a bad thing as well.
So this is something Bradshaw and Holtzapfel call strong selection pressure.
Meaning there are rewards for getting the timing right, you get to live.
And negative consequences to getting the timing wrong. Now here is what's interesting about all this. The factors that determine what's too late and what's too early for the mosquito are shifting with climate change.
Okay.
What happens when you go into dormancy too late?
You die.
You die.
With climate change, winters are milder than they used to be. So the cutoff point separating the mosquitoes that die from the ones that live is actually arriving later in the year. Or another way to look at it, mosquito populations in the far north go into dormancy around a week later than they did 30 years ago.
It sounds like that there's some sort of optimal window in time and that window is shifting later in the year.
Well, it's thanks in part to that variation, right? By having a range of timing responses within a population, the pitcher plant mosquito always has a chunk of individuals that get the timing right.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And make it through the window to pass on their genes.
And because they have short generation times, the mosquito can evolve in a time period as short as 5 years, right?
Exactly. Though it's kind of a bittersweet thing for Bradshaw and Holtzapfel.
We feel the fact that Waiamaya is able to adapt and evolutionarily change in response to rapid climate change is a very positive thing. It makes us feel happy. At the same time, we are not so naive to think that we can take its success and say that that reflects what is going to happen to large mammals and to humans, for example.
You know, if you think about it, a mosquito can go through many generations in the time it takes a polar bear to learn its first baby steps.
Yikes. So that means many species aren't going to be able to bob and weave here. I mean, they're not going to be able to adapt, especially in the hardest hit areas of the globe. We've heard about the poles, but there's another red zone. Coming up after the break, the heat is on in Australia. You're listening to the DNA Files. We'll be back in a minute.
To listen to extended interviews from this program, go to our website, dnafiles.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back to the DNA Files. I'm John Huckenberry here with reporter Adam Burke. Adam?
Hi again.
We're exploring climate change as an evolutionary phenomenon, a force that's rejiggering the planet on both a physical level and a genetic level. And we've sent our producer Adam out into the world. Out into the world. Did you hear that, Adam? To find out how global warming is pushing species around. Before the break, we heard how species are shifting around geographically, changing their seasonal timing, and adapting genetically in response to a warming world.
But if, on the other hand, you don't have that kind of wiggle room?
For example, if you happen to be a little colony of branching coral on Australia's Great Barrier Reef.
And we're not saying that you are.
But let's just say for the sake of argument that you are a small reddish-brown colony of coral, about the size of a head of cauliflower, attached to a lumpy stretch of reef. It's not like you can pack up the store and head south or north or wherever things might be better. You're stuck. You just sit there. Sounds like we're on a boat. What happened? Are we on a boat?
We are on a boat near the Lizard Island Research Station, which is at the northern end of the Great Barrier Reef.
Okay.
And a team of divers from James Cook University are getting ready to collect the kind of coral you were just talking about.
You mean the small reddish-brown, about the size of a head of cauliflower coral?
Yeah, that one. Passalopera damicornis. the kind marine biologist Morgan Pratchett studies.
It's one of the more important corals in terms of habitat for fish and other invertebrates which tend to live within the branches of corals. So we're going to go collect a heap of these corals and see what's inside them.
Inside of coral? What's inside of coral?
Well, he's looking for little crabs and shrimp and starfish and other critters that live in the nooks and crannies of the branches.
Uh-huh.
So soon they're swimming around 15 feet below the surface, prying loose colonies of Passeropora damocornis. Now that's just one of over 300 species of coral on the Great Barrier Reef. They come in all sizes, shapes, and colors.
Most typically that ranges from brown to green to blue, and really quite dark colors.
Some look like big thickets of branching antlers. Others are round and solid, textured like brains. But the structure you see is not the coral animal. It's a calcified skeleton of sorts.
It's like the house of the animal, I guess, right?
More like a high-rise building. And the tiny coral animal is attached to the calcified structure.
Mm-hmm.
And living inside the cell tissue of this coral animal are microscopic single-celled plant species called, brace yourself for this, John, zooxanthellae.
Zooxanthellae? Hey, how do you like me now? That is a mouthful, though.
Yeah, and it's this symbiosis that allows corals to grow all these fancy structures. The photosynthetic plant harnesses energy from the sun and passes on nutrients to the coral animal, and the coral animal gives nutrients to the plant.
So this animal and plant working together build all these fabulous apartment buildings. Is it a happy relationship?
It's a happy relationship most of the time, but it falls apart when times get tough. Pollution, changes in ocean salinity, temperature extremes.
Any number of these factors could cause a coral to become physiologically stressed, and as a consequence, it'll undergo bleaching. And bleaching is a process where the symbiotic algae, the zooxanthellae, essentially evicted from the coral host.
This bleaching business sounds serious. I mean, can the coral roommates get back together?
Well, that depends on how extreme the stress factors are. Historically, bleaching events were small and local, but over the last few decades, warmer ocean temperatures have brought regional-scale bleaching. In 1998, it's estimated that 12 to 15% of the world's corals died. So, with global temperatures going up, Morgan Pratchett is trying to understand the relationship between reef biodiversity and the presence of living coral.
We don't know all the myriad of organisms which live on a reef, but if we just think about coral reef fish, at least 70% of those species decline in abundance after a bleaching event.
And don't forget, it's the fish that bring in all those snorkeling tourists.
Right.
Worth about $5 billion Australian dollars a year.
Whoa, that's how the food chain works, I guess. It's not just a few scientists who are wringing their hands over climate change and coral reefs, eh?
Nope.
So it seems that the key question here is, can coral actually adapt to warmer oceans, even though it's stuck right where it is?
Well, some scientists say no.
Oh.
And the reason is that symbiosis we were talking about earlier.
You mean the zooxanthellae business with the little coral animal you were talking about?
Yeah, it's a tricky evolutionary relationship. I mean, let's say one of these symbiotic zooxanthellae is floating around in the ocean.
Okay.
Just a little cell. And then that little cell bumps into the particular species of coral host that it likes to live with.
Okay.
That symbiont has to get inside a cell of the coral animal, which is not the easiest thing to do.
Cells spend a lot of energy trying to prevent things from invading them because they're a little lump of energy and they're trying to keep it for themselves, right?
Meet Ove Hogelberg, a marine biologist at the University of Queensland.
There are these immune systems and there's ways of destroying invading pathogens and bacteria and so on. And then suddenly it's come inside and live inside my cell. You know, I'm not going to fear you, I'm going to live with you. And, of course, that's a very bizarre situation when you think about it.
I'll say, but they are coral, after all. And how do these coral know if you're a friendly cell or an enemy cell?
What we do know is that there are some molecules on the surface of the right type of zooxanthellae which are being recognized by systems on the coral side. And this is acting essentially like a set of keys. You get the key to the first room if you get into the cell. A broad range of cells might actually get taken in. But what happens next is, if they're the wrong type, then they get attacked by little parts of the host cell called lysosomes, and they're eliminated that way. So if you have the first set of keys, you get into that first room, If you have the second set of keys, you avoid digestion. Then the next trick is, of course, you've now got to integrate into the physiology of the host. So this is like the third set of keys. And this is where you have the ability to take up nutrients from the host and to pump out sugars and make sure that you start to grow in the tissues.
So it's pretty complex and delicate on the molecular level. And we're talking about two species that have both evolved together. And Hogelberg believes that coevolution took a long time.
I think the problem with this is it's not a single character. It's a whole set of genes which are involved in symbiosis, which have to be concerted in their evolution. You know, maybe hundreds of genes have to slowly co-evolve with the host to get to a point where they've got this sophisticated and intimate relationship between the two cells.
Now, that's not saying corals can't evolve to cope with increased temperatures. In fact, there's evidence that they can and have. The Great Barrier Reef is 1,400 miles long. Temperatures range from one end to the other. And you can find the same coral symbiont combination living in different locations with different temperature tolerances. So Terry Hughes, who runs the ARC Center for Marine Excellence in Townsville, Queensland, says it's premature to say whether corals will adapt or not.
Clearly, corals are locally adapted to the temperature regime that they're currently found at. We don't know how long that local adaptation took. It might have taken millennia. So the million-dollar question is, can corals adapt to rapidly rising temperatures? And we don't know the answer to that.
They do know these mass bleaching events can be somewhat selective. Some species are surviving better than others.
We're already seeing a shift in the composition of species in favor of species that are more resistant to bleaching.
So in the short run anyway, Hughes believes we'll continue to have what he calls vibrant coral reefs if we can slow the rate of climate change.
I don't want to overstate the optimism. I think coral reefs are going to be degraded, but I don't think we're going to see them destroyed in 30 years. We're going to see a shift in species composition. But if we can limit the temperature rise to 2 or 3 degrees...
That's 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit.
And if we take strong action now, then I think we've got considerable optimism in terms of the future of coral reefs.
So Terry Hughes sounds hopeful here. And I have to say, it's kind of a relief to hear that reefs won't be destroyed in the short run.
On the raw face of it, yes, that's correct.
There's Ove Hogelberg again.
Yeah, and he would tell you the changes that Terry Hughes is talking about aren't just cosmetic.
I think it's a little misleading to say that they're going to be anything like a coral reef as we know it today. Because corals, I think, will be quite rare organisms. They've got huge ranges. They can reproduce asexually. So there's no problem about corals in the short term as far as extinction. But in terms of their dominance of ecosystems like the Great Barrier Reef, I think they will be rare members of the community.
When it comes to extinction, it's difficult to know exactly which species are next. But that doesn't stop scientists from trying to understand how rare species will fare with this climate change business. I mean, I'd want to know if I was next.
Me too.
So just west of the Great Barrier Reef, along the northeast edge of Australia, there are scientists who are studying species at risk. And you went out with them into the woods, Adam, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me if I have this right. These are a chain of mountains in Australia known as the wet tropics.
That's right. That's right.
High altitude, right? Cool, misty rainforests.
It's exactly right. The wet tropics are some of the last shreds of an ecosystem that once blanketed Australia. And Steve Williams studies the plants and animals that live only in the wet tropics. In other words, found nowhere else in the world. He's an ecologist based at James Cook University in Townsville, Queensland. But more often than not, you can find him out in the rainforest with a research team documenting biodiversity.
There's another possum way up in the canopy.
Oh, yeah.
It's another lemuroid.
So it's the middle of the night, and we're out with flashlights counting the marsupial possums that we can spot in the tree canopy. These animals are about the size of a cat. They're hundreds of feet up, but you can actually identify them by the color and shape of their eye shine, or at least Steve Williams can. We're also on the lookout for other nocturnal animals, owls, bats, a rare species of kangaroo that lives in trees.
Oh, man, dude, you saw kangaroos that live in trees? That's
We didn't see any.
Oh.
But one of the students caught a lizard called a leaf-tailed gecko, and we all gathered around. A foot long, mottled green and tan coloring, bulging yellow eyes.
Cool.
Yeah, well, these things rely on camouflage. You can see by the pattern they look like the lichen on tree bark. And their tail is leaf-shaped, which is what gives them their name, leaf-tailed geckos. And even their eyes have camouflage pattern on them. Give them a little squeak. Hey, cutie.
Wow, they are really beautiful.
They are. They're fantastic. One of my favorite animals.
With a tail shaped like a leaf and yellow camouflaged eyes.
It looks like a creature from another planet.
Oh, man.
The belly's just like soft as silk, isn't it? Yeah. You feel the belly.
Can I feel the belly too? Oh.
In the last few million years, climate has fluctuated wildly in the wet tropics. For example, the last ice age, 18,000 years ago, caused the region to dry out considerably, leaving just tiny islands of cool, misty rainforest on a few mountaintops.
As the rainforest contracts, each one of those mountaintops becomes more and more isolated and smaller area. Sometimes if it gets too small or the rainforest completely disappears, the populations in that area would have gone extinct. And as the rainforest has expanded again over the last 5,000 years, species have been able to recolonize those mountains.
So climate has crunched the forest down to these tiny isolated pockets, and then they've expanded out again and crunched down again and expanded out again.
And the tiny isolated pockets that remained became kind of these life rafts for many species of vertebrates. That's where they hunkered down and rode out the dry times. Creatures like the lemuroid ringtail possum.
And I'm almost afraid to ask, the tree kangaroo?
Yep, and the tree kangaroo, and birds and frogs, and our friend the leaf-tailed gecko.
Your friend.
My friend. All of these different critters survived in tiny patches of forest that were left on mountaintops.
So whatever happened to your little leaf-tailed gecko pal? I mean, what did the scientists do with it?
Well, they weigh it, measure it, record the coordinates where it was found, and they take a DNA sample.
That's interesting. I don't know how interesting for the gecko, but it's interesting.
It is really interesting. Part of this story of past climate change can be found in the genes of these animals.
Really?
Yeah, which is why Steve Williams is working with a population geneticist named Craig Moritz at the University of California, Berkeley, to decode this story of past isolation.
Take a population down to a very small size, it loses a lot of its genetic variation. And that loss of genetic variation takes a long time to recover. You have to get it back by mutation, and that takes tens of thousands of years to do. So there's a record of history sitting in the DNA that we can use to try and estimate what was the population size like through time from the pattern of variation.
So, for example, if a population of leaf-tailed geckos were confined to a mountaintop thousands of years ago, that population is going to have a recognizable genetic signature.
Just because of a mountain? Why?
Well, remember, Craig Moritz said, take a population down to a very small size, and it's going to lose a lot of its genetic variation. Okay, here, let's think about it this way. See this bag of candy?
This bag of candy right here?
That bag of candy.
Oh.
There are 13 different colors of jelly beans inside.
You've already inspected this?
I have already inspected it. Now reach in, grab a small handful, and put them in that bowl.
All right.
Just a small handful, John.
There's some for you. Don't worry.
Okay, so what colors do you have?
All right. I've got some dark blues, two yellows, a brown one, some red ones.
So just four of the 13 colors.
Yep, that's all I got.
So it's not really a surprise, right, that there's going to be less variety in the bowl than there is in the whole bag? I mean, odds are really low that you're going to have all the colors, right?
Right, so 13 colors in the bag, only four in my little bowl here.
The same thing happens with leaf-tailed geckos when their habitat crunches down to a little island on a mountaintop.
Right.
That bag represents the diversity before the crunch. The candy in your hand represents the genetic diversity of geckos remaining on a particular mountaintop after the crunch.
Okay.
Okay, so now reach in the bag and get another handful and tell me the colors.
All right. All right, we've got one brown, some yellows, some orange ones, and some green ones.
So that represents the genetic diversity of geckos on another mountaintop.
Different combinations of colors.
And each combination represents a different genetic signature.
Which allows our geneticist Moritz to tell descendants of one population from another.
Exactamundo. So they start with some genetic data collected from leaf-tailed geckos throughout the wet tropics.
So we look at the leaf-tailed geckos. We see two genetic groups. Within each population, the level of variation is exceptionally low, which suggests they contracted back to a very small population.
And because they've mapped where each genetic gecko sample came from, they know something about where these creatures survived during the rough times.
There are different numbers of genetic clusters, if you like, within each species. So the leaf-tailed gecko had just two, one north, one south, very, very clear picture. In others, there could be five or six or seven different genetic groups, which implies that they survived the glacial periods in multiple places.
There are actually a whole range of genetic signatures that tell Moritz where species hunkered down, where they went locally extinct, and how long it took them to spread back out again.
It's like DNA is a map. I mean, Steve Williams is out there running around in the woods, catching lizards and frogs and taking tiny tissue samples, which he sends to Craig Moritz.
And Craig Moritz uses the genetic signatures to reconstruct a story of how that map has changed over time for the gecko and many other species in the wet tropics.
It's like trying to read molecular tea leaves. You know, what's in the bottom of the cup and what did that mean about the past? You need to draw multiple lines of evidence. And it's when you put all the different lines of evidence together, we can build up a fairly consistent picture of what happened.
Williams and Moritz are also using their information to estimate how these species are going to cope with rising temperatures now, based on what happened in the past.
How much warming is predicted here?
Between 3 and 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
The Fahrenheit thing again. And what do they say will happen to the wet tropic species?
Similar to what happened in the past. As temperatures increase, these species will retreat up to the highest reaches of the mountains until there's nothing above but blue sky.
I think the consensus at the moment is that this is a type of climate that these faunas simply haven't experienced in the last few million years. And these species which formerly evolved in much cooler, wetter climates are going to get hammered. So I desperately hope these models are wrong, and we're doing everything we can to disprove them.
Coming up, a species that is changing the climate. This is The Heat is On, Evolution in Action. We'll be back in a minute.
To learn more about the science mentioned in this program, go to our website, dnafiles.org. This is NPR.
Welcome back. I'm John Hockenberry. A century ago, asthma was a rarity. Today, it's a scourge for 300 million people around the world, most of whom live in Western countries, where asthma has become the most common chronic disease of childhood. The obvious suspect is our man-made environment. But asthma is a heritable disorder, involving dozens of genes, some connected to the lungs, some connected to the immune system, and that all vary from person to person. Scientists need a map of that underlying genetic variation to have any hope of pinning down the scope and action of the environmental causes of asthma. In 1992, scientists began a massive study in about a dozen Southern California communities examining the effects of air pollution and other environmental exposures on the respiratory health of children. But more recently, they have been trying to understand how genetic makeup and environmental factors interact, as producer John Kalish reports.
Seth and Karina Hamilton live with their two kids in a middle-class section of Long Beach known as Belmont Heights. Mom, Dad, and their son all have asthma.
My name is Richard Hamilton.
And how old are you?
5.
Got any animals in your house?
A doggy.
Named?
Belle.
Why can't we have a kitty?
Because we don't want a kitty.
Are you allergic to kitties?
Yes.
And do those make your asthma worse?
Yes.
Asthma began at different times in the Hamilton family. Karina, the mom, has had it her whole life, as did her mother. Karina's sister and niece also suffer from asthma. And son Ricky has had it most of his young life. Her husband Seth, however, didn't develop asthma until the family moved to Long Beach.
The doctor says you've got it really bad and it isn't going away and you're going to be stuck with this now.
For him, it was kind of annoying to be having to take these medicines.
Yeah.
To me, it's just old hat. I've been taking them all my life, at least some form of them, and I just said, well, welcome to the club, honey.
Yeah.
Now you know what the kids and I feel like.
With so many cases of asthma in their family, the Hamiltons are inclined to believe that heredity plays a role. But they also realize that air pollution in Southern California may have caused Seth's asthma and may be making asthma worse for Karina and Ricky.
I've often thought, should we be here?
Is there somewhere better that we can live, or are we just in L.A. and L.A.'s got polluted air because there's too many cars and too much industry, and where would we go? I don't know.
There's been a number of studies trying to identify genes involved that might explain this inheritance in families.
Dr. Frank Gilliland is a professor of preventive medicine at the University of Southern California.
But we know that you can't just focus on the genes. You have to think about the combinations of the genes and the environmental exposures together. If we just think of the environment and we just think of the genes, then we're not going to make very much progress.
Gilliland and his colleagues at USC and UCLA are part of the Southern California Environmental Health Sciences Center. Since 1992, Gilliland has been studying the respiratory health of thousands of Southern California schoolchildren. This children's health study has focused on how air pollution affects kids. Not only does Southern California have some of the most polluted air in the nation, but the city of Long Beach has some of the worst pollution in the region. Scientists and public officials say the asthma rate in Long Beach is double that of the rest of California. The source of most of the pollution is the port of Long Beach, the second largest port in America. Art Wong with the Long Beach Harbor Department stands on a pier watching a 15-story high crane pluck containers from a giant ship and place them on the beds of waiting tractor trucks.
Each year about $100 billion worth of products are shipped through here, and that's clothing, toys, furniture, TVs, everything you can think of in a shopping mall or at a Home Depot has probably come through here.
Fueled by increasing global trade, the volume of ship traffic here is expected to triple in the next 15 to 20 years. For the people who live in this busy port city, that will mean a lot more exhaust in the air from the ships. Many of these giant vessels burn bunker fuel, a low-grade form of diesel. Just one of these ships emits the same amount of air pollution as 12,000 cars. Diesel-burning trucks and freight trains then haul the containers onto local freeways or nearby rail yards, passing through residential areas of Long Beach. The Hudson School on the west side of Long Beach serves grades K through 8. It's on a suburban street lined with beautiful violet jacaranda trees. But the rear of the school faces the terminal freeway, where some 3,000 trucks a day, most heading to or from the local piers, drive by spewing diesel exhaust. Researchers say data indicates that truck exhaust pushes the asthma rate up in Long Beach. In early 2007, local parents used air monitoring equipment provided by the Southern California Environmental Health Sciences Center and found high levels of particulate matter both inside and outside the school. Particulates are tiny solid or liquid particles of diesel exhaust that can get stuck in the lungs, triggering asthma attacks. Suzanne Arnold is a nurse at the Hudson School.
Trucks are literally 20 feet from the chain link fence at the back of the playground where the children are playing. There have been a number of occasions when I've had to go out to the field with my wheelchair and bring a child back to the office or take an inhaler to them and wheel them back into the office. That usually happens when the weather is warmer and when they've been running. That's usually when I have that kind of a problem.
Nurse Arnold says that protecting the health of kids in her school made it necessary for her to speak out against a proposed rail facility across the freeway from the school. That rail yard would bring even more trucks and trains into the area. But there's no simple relationship between asthma and air pollution. Even at the Hudson School, not every child will develop asthma. Yes, pollutants can bring on an asthma attack, but so can emotional stress, mold, and cold air. Professor Gilliland and USC biostatistician Jim Gouderman have been studying a number of genes and genetic variations that are thought to make people either susceptible or resistant to pollutants. For example, one gene called GSTM1 helps the body rid itself of toxins that enter through the lungs. Jim Gouderman.
GSTM1 is what I think of as a garbage truck gene. It goes around and tries to clean up the garbage, meaning things like external environmental toxins. And people that have the null genotype don't have that garbage truck to go around and pick up those kinds of toxins.
40% to 50% of the people in the world are this null genotype, meaning they don't have a working GSTM1 gene. A study led by Dr. Frank Gilliland found that kids who don't have the GSTM1 gene are at greatest risk for developing asthma if they're exposed to certain environmental toxins, even in the womb.
If you're missing this gene, then if you're exposed to, say, an allergen you're allergic to and an environmental exposure like diesel exhaust, your responses are 20-fold higher than if you had this gene. We don't really understand all the different mechanistic bases for why this gene is so important, and we're frankly surprised by it, but there's lots of work being done on trying to understand that better.
That work is complicated by the fact that GSTM1 is just one of roughly 20 known genes that seem to work together and have strong ties to asthma in multiple populations. Many more genes, perhaps 30 to 50, seem to chime in for different people at different times.
Is there anything such as an asthma gene, the gene that is going to explain asthma? The answer is no, I think. That leaves us with a constellation of genes.
Donata Vercelli is assistant director of the Arizona Respiratory Center at the University of Arizona. Not only is asthma genetically complex, says Vercelli, it clearly shows evidence of epigenetic effects, genes that work differently based on the environment.
What we see is that a certain gene can be associated with less asthma in a certain environment, with more asthma in another environment, and with no effect in yet another environment. I think that it is only epigenetics that make it possible for the same gene to do the opposite thing.
It is exactly this astonishing ability of the environment to change the way our DNA works, says Vercelli, that makes it essential to identify the responsible environmental factors.
Because we can't change the genes, but we can act on the environment.
Dr. Gilliland says genetic and environmental science will have an important role to play in the development of public policies to curb the kind of air pollution that affects kids at the Hudson School.
Right now, there really are no regulations that are directed toward being exposed to proximity to busy roadways or freeways. And you can imagine it's a whole nother level of regulatory approach that would be needed in terms of long-term land use planning and school siting and other things that need to be considered to be able to address this potential threat to children and asthma in particular.
In the meantime, work continues at the Southern California Environmental Health Sciences Center to develop a better understanding of how the genetic and environmental underpinnings of asthma work, using genetic samples from thousands of Southern California school children. Gilliland and Gouderman hope to identify what they suspect are tens or maybe even hundreds of genetic variations that play a role in asthma. For the DNA Files, I'm John Kalish.
Once upon a time, scientists racing to sequence the human genome believed they would soon have the map to disease susceptibility. Now we know that a complex regulatory system of epigenetic mechanisms, the epigenome, can alter and even reverse gene function in different environments. Scientists suddenly find themselves, like eager cave explorers, back facing a baffling network of dark passages, uncertain which way to proceed. But the Pima Indians don't have the luxury to wait around. For health reasons, they need to act. And while the epigenetics of complex diseases like asthma and obesity remain obscure, some of the environmental components are coming into clearer view.
As Vicky Monks tells us, this is the challenge for the Pima. What to do right now.
In the cool of a late spring desert evening, Rose Martin and Terrell Dew Johnson are picking buds from the Cholla cactus. The buds are unopened cactus flowers, one of the desert plants that Pima Indians relied on for centuries. Scientists now understand that Cholla buds and other desert foods actually slow down the release of sugars into the bloodstream. They're the perfect foods for preventing diabetes. Karen Blaine is sautéing cholla buds with olive oil, onions, and garlic, a cooking demonstration.
It's very high in calcium. One tablespoon is equal to an 8-ounce glass of milk.
It's one of the strategies TOCA, Tohono O'odham Community Action, is using to promote dietary changes. Cooking lessons will only go so far, though, if the foods aren't available, so TOCA's taken on that mission, too. TOCA's co-director Tristan Reeder is checking the old irrigation pumps watering farmland on a remote stretch of the reservation where TOCA's growing traditional crops, corn, squash, watermelon, and tepary beans.
If you tell someone you need to eat these foods, but they can't go to the grocery store and buy them, they no longer farm, they're not available anywhere, then all the choices in the world make no sense.
So TOCA's raising traditional food crops on a commercial scale. The effort could go a long way in improving health here, but projects like this don't get much government support. Pima Indians in Arizona have cooperated with government scientists for decades, and all the while, diabetes and obesity rates were escalating. Reeder believes that the Pimas would be better off if just a fraction of the millions spent on genetic research could have gone to helping people lead healthier lives.
There's a real sense that research has made Native peoples the subjects of the research, but never the beneficiaries, that they've never really been partners. It says there's something wrong with you fundamentally, genetically, and it's hopeless unless the scientists find an answer. What we're saying is no, you do have the capacity to choose what you eat, to engage in traditional games and traditional dancing and other forms of physical fitness. You do have that power within yourself, within your family, within your village, within your community to really make changes.
I think that if I was Pima, I would be very disappointed too.
Eric Ravison.
Because these people have provided help to the scientific community for almost 40 years now, and they have more obesity, they have more type 2 diabetes. But the thing that we don't know without these studies, without the careful checking of the population, it would be even worse.
Pima Indians are faced with trying to reverse the effects from 75 years of escalating health problems brought on by abrupt, drastic changes in lifestyle. They can't roll back history and return to completely traditional ways. They live in the modern world. Going back to a subsistence lifestyle, plowing with mules, isn't the answer. But reestablishing healthy food choices and other traditions could help. From what we know now about epigenetics, intervention is most crucial during key points of development, such as during pregnancy as the fetus develops. And that's the part of this epigenetic research that holds promise for the Pimas. Knowing this much, it's possible to do something, even before all of the science is fully understood. From the Tohono O'odham Reservation, I'm Vicky Monks.
So we return to the question with which we began. Why do some people get sick while others remain healthy in the same environment? Could it be that large parts of our modern lives, the food we eat, the air we breathe, the uncounted details of life in our all-enveloping man-made world, have become an accidental epigenetic experiment? Are we rewriting heredity by inadvertently tinkering with the software that controls our genes or our children's genes? As scientists grope their way towards a new paradigm of gene-environment interaction, we must all take another look at how we choose to live. For what we eat, drink, breathe, how we work and play may exact a personal toll not only on us, but on our children and their children to come. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening to the DNA Files.
To find out more about genes and environment, visit our website at dnafiles.org, where you can download a podcast of this program. This series, The DNA Files, was produced by Sound Vision Productions with funding by the National Science Foundation, U.S. Department of Energy, National Institutes of Health, and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. This program, Rewriting Heredity, Environment and the Genome, was produced by John Rieger, John Kalish, and Vicky Monks. The DNA Files is Managing Editor Loretta Williams, Editor Deborah George, Science Content Editor Sally Lehrman, Research Director is Addie Gevins. Production support by Noah Miller, Julie Kane, and Liza Grafeo. Office support provided by Steve Nunez and Beverly Fitzgerald. Our web director is Jenna Allison. Technical engineer and music director is Robin Wise. Our host is John Hockenberry. Our theme music was composed and performed by Steve White. Additional music by Steve White, Conrad Pretzel, and Robert Powell. Marketing of the DNA Files is by Sharp Media. Legal services by Cooper, White & Cooper and Spencer Weisbroth. Special thanks to Murray Street Productions. Send your responses and letters to feedback@dnafiles.org. For CDs and transcripts, call 888-303-0022. That's 888-303-0022. The executive producer is Barry Scott. This has been a Sound Vision production, distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.
As 2007 draws to a close, we thank you for supporting WILL. There's still time to make a tax-deductible donation now to ensure the public radio, television, and online service you rely on will continue to thrive in 2008. I'm radio station manager Jay Pierce. Help us reach our December 31st fundraising goal of $920,000. Call 217-244-9455 or log on to willpledge.org. Thanks.
The weather forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area today, increasing cloudiness this afternoon and mild with a high of 47. Tonight becoming mostly cloudy with a chance of some light snow, accumulations less than an inch tonight, a low of 30. And then tomorrow becoming partly sunny with a high near 40. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, starting the 2008 calendar year with performances by the Royal Philharmonic, the St. Petersburg Ballet, and pianist Christopher Taylor. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.